History is important. Many people think history is not important, not relevant. But history tells us what has worked, and history tells us what has not worked. We need to develop the ability to recognize these lessons in every area of life. The Bible tells us that the day will come when the kingdoms of the world have become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and Christ shall reign forever and ever. You might recall in Handel's Messiah, as this verse gets hammered home by the choirs, they pound it out, very inspirational. All nations will come and worship before Christ. Winston Churchill said, "The longer you look back, the further you can look forward." In fact, the longer you want to prepare for the future, the further back in history you've got to go. If we don't know our own history, we will simply have to endure all the same mistakes, absurdities, sacrifices all over again. That was said by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the greatest Russian author of the 20th century. Man who got the Nobel Literature Award for his literature contributions. He knew about suffering. He knew about revolution. He spent many years in Stalin's concentration camps in the Gulag Archipelago. He wrote the book, The Gulag Archipelago. He wrote The Cancer Ward, One Day in the Life of Ivan Davinovich, and a whole lot of other outstanding classics that helped us understand the Russian Revolution better than anyone else's writings have done. Those who cannot remember the past are doomed, condemned to repeat it. To be ignorant of what has happened before you were born is to remain a child forever, said Cicero. It is not the remembered past, it's the forgotten past that enslaves us. Regularly you hear people say, oh, the past can enslave you. Well, C.S. Lewis, Oxford and Cambridge professor, pointed out, yes, but it isn't the remembered past that enslaves us, it's the forgotten past. Knowing the past can free us, but not knowing the past means you can be enslaved to it, to repeat it. History is and must ever continue to be, next to God's word, the richest foundation of wisdom and the surest guide to all successful practical activity. John Calvin wrote, "Histories are a true school for learning how to order our lives." And 1 Corinthians 10 verse 6 says, "Now these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things." That was written primarily and firstly about the children of Israel's experience as slaves in Egypt and how God brought them out through the mighty Exodus and what happened in the wilderness. But it's true also for all of history, sacred history and all of history, because God is overall. History is his story, after all. God is sovereign. And so there's always a lot to learn from history when we look at it from a providential point of view. So, the French Revolution. I'm well aware that on the 14th of July, there are people who celebrate Bastille Day. I'm inclined to think that none of the Huguenots who founded the town of Frontignac would have taken part in Bastille Day. First of all, none of the Huguenots were there. They'd been kicked out of France 100 years earlier. And they came here in 1688, and it's in 1789 that the French Revolution took place. But the main thing is, the French Huguenots who came and settled Frontignac were God-fearing, Bible-believing Protestant Christians. I cannot see them celebrating something that was secular, humanist, and anti-Christian. Let me explain. The French Revolution was one of the most influential events of modern history. We all studied it at school. They threw a lot of things at us. And I remember it being presented as something basically good. But the 10-year period from 1789 to 1799, when France went from a monarchy to a constitutional monarchy to a republic to a reign of terror to dictatorship, was one of the most tumultuous times in European history. Much myth and romantic legend has been written on what some politicians would like the French Revolution to have been, but the reality is the French Revolution was actually a monstrous horror, and none of us would have wanted to live through that time. In the name of liberty, equality, fraternity, or death, maybe forget the last two words of that slogan, but it wasn't just liberty, equality, fraternity. It was liberty, equality, fraternity, or death. Over 40,000 people had their heads chopped off by the guillotine. And another 300,000 people were publicly executed by firing squads, being hacked to death, or by drownings and other methods of mass murder. And ultimately, many millions died in the 25 years of war and upheavals that resulted. particularly in the Napoleonic Wars, which in one sense was almost the First World War. Certainly it was the first European-wide war. It involved everyone in Europe, and it was devastating. The French Revolution has been the inspiration and the model for all socialist and communist revolutions in modern history. Lord Acton, a contemporary, in his lectures on the French Revolution, observed, "The appalling thing in the French Revolution is not the tumult, but the design. Through all the fire and smoke, we perceive the evidence of calculating organization. The managers remain studiously concealed and masked, but there's no doubt about their presence from the first." Now, the tools of the French Revolution were disinformation, propaganda, the subversion of language, malice, envy, hatred, jealousy, mass murder, and foreign military adventurism as a diversion to distract the masses from the failure of government. Now, the one thing revolutionaries do is revolutionaries promise the earth. Land, jobs, bread, peace, homes, whatever the people want, they promise. When they get into power, you get less of these things. They fail on their promises. So what do they need to do? Divert the people. Either terrorize them into submission, divert them in foreign military adventurism. Always works. You want an example of this? Just look north of the border of Zimbabwe, and you get an example of how revolutionaries there have worked. You always need scapegoats to blame for the failure of the revolutionary governments, and so on. Now, these tools have been implemented by more modern revolutionaries like Vladimir Lenin and Trotsky and Joseph Stalin, Mao Tse-tung, Che Guevara, Patrice Lumumba, Nicolae Ceausescu, Ho Chi Minh, Pol Pot, and Robert Mugabe. The power-mad and the disenchanted have continued to sing the praises of the French Revolution and to attempt to replicate its ideals. In revolutions as far-field as Russia, China, Cuba, North Korea, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Ethiopia, Mozambique, Angola, the Congo, and Zimbabwe. Demonic forces and enlightenment ideas of humanist philosophers like Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Voltaire prepared the ground for revolution. Historian Otto Scott observed, "French intellectuals, middle class and upper classes, had grown ashamed of their country, of their history, and of the institutions. Such a phenomenon had never before arisen in any country or nation or race throughout the long history of mankind. A great loosening began. The country slowly came apart." You see, what brings people together, what unites them, is a common faith, common history, common culture, common language, common beliefs and values. When these things are shattered, the people just lose all direction. And you can see families fall apart, countries fall apart, communities come apart, and this happened in France, the first example of such happening. For the first time since the decadent days of Rome, pornography emerged from the caves and circulated openly in a civilized country. The Catholic Church in France was intellectually gutted. The priests lost their faith along with the congregations. Strange cults appeared. Sex rituals, black magic, Satanism, perversion became not only acceptable but fashionable. Homosexuals held public balls to which heterosexuals were invited, and the police guarded their carriages. The air grew thick with plans to restructure and reconstruct all traditional French society and institutions. The heirs of the Enlightenment of the late 18th century launched the first revolution in all history against the ideas of Christianity and Christianity's God. This is a picture of Voltaire. Voltaire was the poison pen. He was the Karl Marx of the French Revolution, the one whose ideas basically launched revolutionaries like Robespierre into action. The press was the spearhead, the font, and the fuel for the revolution. The journals were mixtures of politics and smut. It sounds like some modern tabloids, does it not? They admired the agitators extravagantly, and they never discussed the church without mention of scandal, nor the government without criticism. They relied heavily on tales of sin in high places and high-handed outrages of the court. No name, however highly placed and illustrious, escaped. And of course, one of the main examples of this would be how Marie Antoinette was trashed in the media. To this day, One of the only quotes the average person knows about the French Revolution is that Queen Marie Antoinette said, if they don't have bread, let them eat cake. Of course, that's absolute fabrication. There's no way she ever said it. No historian takes that seriously or believes that it's possible that Mary Antoinette said it. Mary Antoinette was somebody who held soup kitchens for the poor. She was someone who was extremely generous and gracious and concerned not only for the people in the upper middle class but for the poor. She sponsored and adopted and she organized educational facilities for them. To put this callous remark, this stupid remark of if they don't have bread, let them eat cake, it's just a propaganda term. Every war has got its propaganda. And she was Austrian, the deadly enemies of the French. She was hated because she was foreign, and also she was targeted because she was more intelligent and had more backbone than the king, and they wanted to ostracize and destroy her. Now, yet, despite this being a patent lie, patent propaganda, this, if they don't have bread, let them eat cake, has entered even to school textbooks as though it's fact. No serious historian takes this seriously. They have the affair of the necklace, maybe you know that, where Mary Antoinette is meant to have bought this necklace that cost several million francs at that time money. Spectacular diamond. There's no way that she had anything to do with it. It was a propaganda stunt designed to embarrass the Queen. And yet, anybody who's an historian and has actually looked at the facts doesn't believe the Queen had anything to do with it. It was just designed to discredit her. And yet, there are many today who've got a superficial understanding who think it's a fact. So through the journals, through the pamphlets, the press could distort, colour, plead, argue, lie, report, and misreport the information upon which the balance of the realm depended. People can't make intelligent decisions unless they're fed with the truth. When you're given false information, you're not going to make wise choices. The French involvement in the American War of Independence against Great Britain created an enormous debt for France. Now, this is significant. No revolutions take place in absolute economic stability. Something always happens to destabilize the economy to create the grounds for revolution. And if you believed the writings of Voltaire and the writings of the press in France at the time of the French Revolution, you'd say France had bankruptcy and France had financial trouble because Marie Antoinette was extravagant. And because she's buying million franc necklaces and things like that. Actually, they were bankrupt because of their war against Great Britain on the side of the United States of America. But that only compounded an earlier war. The father of Louis XVI had gotten them involved in a 7 years war against Great Britain, Prussia, which was so catastrophic. It lost France its greatest prize overseas, which was Canada. In the 7 years war, they lost Canada, and they lost so much money, they were bankrupt. Louis XVI inherited a bankrupt state, and he compounded it with a war of revenge against Britain to get them back. Okay, you caused us to lose Canada, we're going to make you lose the United States, the American colonies. And so this bankruptcy went upon bankruptcy. And these two ruinous wars absolutely devastated France. The colossal debt added up to the financial crisis, which propelled the French state into bankruptcy. King Louis XVI actually began his reign wisely. He dismissed a large number of corrupt and incompetent ministers inherited from the court of his father, Louis XV. He appointed an excellent economist, Anne-Robert Jacques Turgot, as the Comptroller General. And Turgot proposed a drastic solution to France's crisis, the cancellation of tax privileges for the nobles, the abolition of industrial monopolies, removal of restrictions on free enterprise, and other bold practical measures. However, the nobles pressured Louis XVI to dismiss Turgot. This was suicidal. The very people who prevented the solution to France's economic crises lost their heads. It was an extremely suicidal move. And Louis XVI, unfortunately, was a weak king who succumbed to pressure too easily. He didn't listen to intelligent advice of his wife as often as he should have, and he listened to the pressures of these nobles who actually were so blinded by their own foolishness they had no idea how they were sealing their own destruction. The young banker Jacques Necker was then given a task of managing this unmanageable bankrupt economy. And he bravely tried some short-term measures to stave off the inevitable economic collapse. But when he attempted to move towards adopting Togo's free market strategies, the privileged nobles and the wealthy middle class forced the king to dismiss him too. This sealed their fate. This was in 1781. Louis entrusted one hapless man after another with a financial crisis, but all to no avail. France's international credit rating was plummeting, and the country was no longer able to secure loans. By mid-1788, the government had become paralyzed and no longer able to avoid admitting bankruptcy. The king was forced to reinstate Necker, and he called for a meeting of the Estates General to be convened in May 1789. The Estates General had not been convened in generations. The Estates General consisted of three houses. The first estate was the clergy. The second estate was the nobles. The third estate were the merchants and the common people. Although the third house had twice as many representatives as the other houses, each house was understood historically to have only one vote. So you had three votes, one per house. But Louis's government failed to specify how the three houses of the States General were to function, nor did he provide them with any agenda or constitution. This was fatal. You get a bunch of people together in a time of crisis and you don't provide any direction or any solution, what's going to happen? Well, the commoners in the third house boldly organized themselves into a self-contained national assembly, something that never happened before. The nobles were outraged. They convinced Louis XVI to send troops to blockade the hall where the assembly planned to meet. Too little, too late. And the third estate then met in a nearby tennis court and vowed to continue in session until it could complete a new constitution for the nation. Now, this was outright rebellion against the authority of the king. Yet on the 27th of June 1789, Louis ordered the other two estates to join the commoners in the new combined assembly. You could say on that day, the fate of the monarchy was sealed. Their power was broken. Their authority was compromised. There was no turning back. The National Assembly spent most of its time debating the latest philosophical and political theories, most of which were Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Voltaire's writings. And the Marquis de Lafayette, who had achieved fame through his involvement in the American War of Independence, espoused the cause of freedom and rallied the liberal wing of nobles around him. He was, of course, inspired by the American Revolution, although I wouldn't call the American War of Independence a revolution. I think it's a bad term, because the American War of Independence was a war of independence. They were fighting for self-determination. There was no guillotine, there was no hanging of civilians, there was no execution of public officials. It was battles in the field. There was no terrorism, there was no reign of terror. There was no revolution in the sense that we often think of revolution. So to call what happened in America a revolution, I think, is an abuse of language. And it's confusing. I think it's far clearer to speak about the American War of Independence than the American Revolution. It was very different. And the death toll in the American War of Independence, by the way, was 18,500. A lot less than you might have thought for such a long war and such pitched battles. That doesn't even come close to half the death toll from the guillotine alone. So you can't exactly compare America's war between combatants and the French Revolution, which is a reign of terror against civilians. Now, the Count of Mirabeau dominated the assembly through his eloquent campaign for constitutional monarchy. But the most fanatical extremist gravitated to Maximilian Robespierre, indicated on the right, who was a strong devotee of the writings of radical philosophers Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Voltaire. And Voltaire's pictures on the left. Jean-Jacques Rousseau wrote that it is necessary to have a cohesive force to organize and coordinate the movements of society's members. Now, Rousseau is what we today would call a communist. He would have been called a communard at that stage. He's the one who popularized the idea of the noble savage. To him, civilization was evil, and the highest ethical standard you could rise to was to be a naked savage running around in the Pacific Islands eating your neighbors. He said the more primitive, the more noble, the more civilized, and the more evil. And so he's the one who popularized the concept of the noble savage. Rousseau advocated constant agitation for equality in order to maintain an atmosphere of fear where individual differences will not be tolerated. One of his slogans was, do away with the family. Now, he led the way in this. Rousseau had 5 children, all illegitimately, all by different women, and he abandoned them all to the poorhouse. He never visited them, he never wrote to them, he never had communication with them, he didn't support them. And he even wrote a book to support this, saying that the family is the greatest obstacle to revolution, and the family is the greatest obstacle to having a noble society of citizens. Because families prejudice the next generation by bringing them up with the faith and the values of the parents. But he said he was doing his children a favor by abandoning them to the state to be brought up in a poorhouse, separated from family love, because he said his father did him a disservice by giving him love and attention and support, because it made him soft and made him civilized. But by forcing his children to grow up in a harsh environment of a poorhouse, they'd be more the citizens of the revolution and citizens of the future, because they were raised by the state, free from the prejudices and the values and the faith of the parents. And so this man actually went so far as to write an entire book justifying his abandonment of all parental and paternal instincts. Just incredible you could go against your own flesh and blood in this way. But that was Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Inspired by the defiance of the assembly and stirred up by the revolutionary pamphlets and speeches, mobs began to roam the streets of Paris, attacking and murdering royal officials. France's financial house of cards collapsed. Capital fled the country. Economic depression resulted. A series of events combined to create food shortages and hunger. Agitators panned out across the countryside to destroy the grain stores and to terrorize the inhabitants. Hired mobs staged spontaneous riots in Paris. The powers of government collapsed. Everything fell apart with astonishing coordination. In reaction, some of the nobles persuade the king to seek to reassert royal authority. These nobles who advised the king, who had his ear, seem to have always managed to choose the wrong time and the wrong solution. Soldiers are ordered into the streets of Paris as a show of strength. And the appearance of these soldiers provoked and inspired the mobs to seize whatever weapons they could and to storm the old fortress of the Bastille. And so the French Revolution is officially dated from this point, the 14th of July, 1789. The Bastille, an old Middle Ages fortress, had become a symbol of hated tyranny, and much legend has grown out of this event. One of the legends is how they liberated hundreds of political prisoners who were rotting in the cells of the Bastille. Well, as it so happens, there was not one political prisoner in the Bastille at the time. Not one. And despite the fact that the lieutenant governor of the Bastille, M. Delaunay, that he was guaranteed safe conduct and surrendered the fortress under white flag of truce, the mob massacred the soldiers and the governor and cut off their heads and carried them on spikes throughout the streets. Not a very wonderful event to celebrate, I would have thought. And as body parts of the defenders of the Bastille were paraded through the streets, a mere 7 prisoners, mere common criminals, were found in the Bastille. No political prisoners. When the news reached the palace of Versailles, King Louis was astonished. "This is revolt," he said. And his aide responded, "No, sire, it is a revolution." Probably the second best known quote from the French Revolution. The next day, King Louis appeared simply dressed with no bodyguards, no attendants, and he spoke at the National Assembly. He had ordered the troops to leave Paris. The people would have no reason to fear their king. Louis assured them that he had confidence in the assembly, and the deputies rose to their feet, cheering with great fervor. Now, you see, one of the myths of the French Revolution is Louis XVI was a brutal, harsh, cruel dictator, and he provoked the people to revolution. But that's just propaganda by the revolutionaries. Just as the idea that Tsar Nicholas II of Russia was so harsh and vicious, that is why the revolution occurred in Russia. In fact, the opposite is true. Revolutions occur under reforming and kind kings and leaders. It couldn't have happened under Tsar Alexander or Tsar Nicholas I. It was Tsar Nicholas II was a very kindly, generous Tsar, and that's why he's the one who gave Russia its Duma, its parliament. And by the way, in the Russian Revolution, it wasn't the communists who overthrew the Tsar. It was the parliament, the Duma of Russia under Kerensky, the prime minister, that overthrew the Tsar. The communists overthrew the parliament. And that doesn't make as nice a story. So they kind of cut out the parliament and prime minister Kerensky and just have the Tsar was overthrown by Lenin, which of course is a lie. But there's a lot of this that takes place. You will hear many people talking about, for example, how Robert Mugabe replaced Ian Smith in Rhodesia. Not so. Ian Smith organized, prepared for, one man, one vote, multi-party, multi-racial elections, and we had Prime Minister Abel Muzorewa come to power in Zimbabwe, Rhodesia. He then got talked into the Lancaster House Agreement with the British Crown handover to the British Governor, Lord Soames, and Lord Soames is the one who ignored the Lancaster House Agreement and all the violations of it by Mugabe and handed over the country to Mugabe. But snip, 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 let's cut out what actually happened and make a more interesting story, even though it's not true. And you will find this with every revolution, they rewrite history. Well, 88 of the deputies gathered at the Paris City Hall and took turns speaking to an enormous crowd from the balcony. And the famous 32-year-old Lafayette, the head hero of the American War of Independence, was elected general of the new National Guard. There was nothing like that before. You had the Royal Army, now you've got the National Guard. And Lafayette is a general. Now, he was a well-meaning liberal who, I think to use Lenin's term, he was a useful idiot. He meant well. Lafayette had no idea what he was playing with and what he was encouraging, and later he tried to save the life of the king, but it was too late by then. Lafayette was carried along by forces that he had no idea. He unleashed forces he had no idea what he was doing. He was not a revolutionary. He was merely a liberal who wanted to do good. And he thought he could replicate in Catholic France the kind of War of Independence that he had seen bring about democracy in America. The point is that America was a Protestant state, France was a Catholic state. There's a huge difference between the worldviews in both places, and so it was not going to be the same. And he thought he could have Protestant fruit in a Catholic country, and the foundations just weren't there. Now, while many seemed optimistic for the future, because of all the cheering of the king in downtown Paris, Marie Antoinette was filled with foreboding and burned her private papers. She had more foresight and understanding of what was happening than anybody else, it seems, in the palace at that time. Nobles started to flee the court and flee the country, and many settled across the border because they recognized this is not good and the direction is bad and there's writing on the wall. Well, on the 17th of July, the king traveled to Paris to identify with the revolutionary mob, even wearing their revolutionary cap. And in October, a mob marched to Paris, the famous March of the Women, although many of them plainly had beards, and a lot of these so-called women were just men dressed up as women, but never mind that. They demanded that the king transfer his residence to Paris, carting cannons off to Versailles. Well, on the 6th of October, the royal family were escorted by the rioters to Paris, where they could be under the control of the revolutionaries. Arthur Scott observed that Paris, like the nation, was divided between the many and the few, between the few politically active and the many passive, between the many confused, disorganized, abstracted, and the highly concentrated and organized few. Two clubs came to dominate the assembly at this time. They didn't have political parties as such. They had clubs, but think of each club as being a political party. That should be the closest approximation. The Cordeliers were led by Jean-Jacques Danton and Jean-Paul Marat. Danton and Marat, they were the radicals. But the most radical of all, the Jacobins, were skillfully manipulated by Robespierre. And writers like Engels and Karl Marx regard the Jacobins as the true inspiration for the communists, for the Russian Revolution. The Jacobins were the envy of Karl Marx and Lenin. They admired them. These were their gold standard. This was the example that revolutionaries in the future would follow. It was in the French Revolution that the terms left-wing and right-wing were first coined, because those on the left were the radicals who were proudly adopting the designation of left-wing as a symbol of the revolutionary defiance of Christian tradition. See, in the Bible, those on the right are the sheep and those on the left are the goats. Those on the right are the saved, those on the left are the damned. And so, in the book Fire in the Minds of Men, Origin of Revolutionary Faith, James Billington points out that the French revolutionaries knowingly, deliberately chose left wing to designate themselves, meaning we are against Christianity, we're against God, we're on the left hand side of the throne of God, we are the damned, we are the goats, and we're proud of it. On the 4th of August, 1789, the nobles and clergy renounced their privileges in the name of revolutionary equality. And he had this whole stream, not just a trickle, a stream of people going up to confess to the people their crime and their sin of being of the wrong class, being of the wrong side, and their privileges and so on. And so you had this confession, this purging their souls and pleading for forgiveness from the people, whoever they are. And on the 2nd of November, the Assembly voted to issue a new paper money called assignats, and this sparked off rampant inflation. Funny how communist governments can't seem to have stable currency, because stable currency requires honesty, honest money, real value. They can't seem to do that. Think Zimbabwe dollars. And on the 2nd of November, the Assembly voted to confiscate all church property. And this was the most revolutionary act of all. On July 1790, the Assembly nationalized the Roman Catholic Church by enacting the civil constitution of the clergy. And this picture actually gets to the heart of the French Revolution. Church burning, people being guillotined, women being hung, ministers being hung, some pagan desecrating church, revolutionary cap over the bishop's mitre, and is playing the violin while people die and churches burn. The Assembly undertook to pay the salaries of the priests from the national treasury and to create a French church under the control of the government. Pope Pius VI, of course, had to excommunicate all the clergymen who took this new oath demanded by the Assembly. But as it so happens, most of the clergy refused to take this revolutionary oath, and they were evicted from their pulpits, their parishes, their homes, and France was divided into 83 departments or counties. The National Assembly then produced the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of Citizens. Notice its style in the shape of two tablets. It's consciously emulating the law of God given to Moses, but proclaiming a new law. It's a rejection of the Ten Commandments. Now, I've heard people say, I remember being taught at school, this is the first Bill of Rights in history. That's rubbish. This was patterned after the English Bill of Rights of 1689, which was signed by King William and Queen Mary, and the American Bill of Rights, which had been appended to the American United States Constitution, which was itself based on the Magna Carta of 1215, which is the first true Bill of Rights in all of history, which is written by a past and thoroughly saturated with scripture. So certainly there's no way anyone can say that the French Declaration of the Rights of Man is the first Bill of Rights in history. Rubbish. The first humanistic Bill of Rights. True, but not the first Bill of Rights. Now, the French Declaration embodied mostly humanistic ideas of the Enlightenment. It has some good ideas in it, but the trouble is it doesn't recognize the Creator. The American Constitution recognizes inalienable rights endowed by the Creator. Inalienable rights cannot be rescinded or amended. But rights given by the states could be taken away. In fact, you'll see this Declaration of the Rights of Man didn't even last 2 years. While attempting to adopt many of the reforms of the biblically orientated Magna Carta of 1215, the English Bill of Rights of 1689, the French Declaration of the Rights of Man failed to recognize the Creator and ignored the biblical foundations for freedom. So that's why it really was a dead letter almost as soon as it was written. It never went anywhere. It didn't achieve a thing. The new constitution was completed by 1791 with a single chamber legislature elected by active citizens. And active citizens could be redefined by the state. So whether you had the votes or not depended on a lot of things. It wasn't universal suffrage at all. Before Count Mirabeau died in April 1791, he predicted that all their well-deliberated efforts at reform would collapse and be washed away in a bloodbath. Was he ever right? Louis XVI was then goaded and provoked into a situation where he recognized he's got to flee from France. I have no doubt that this was exactly what the revolutionaries wanted. It's what they engineered. They let them know that they were about to be killed. They knew that their lives were at stake. They had to flee the country. But you know, revolutions need to have a certain amount of drama and a certain amount of key things to take place. As Karl Marx said, you need thesis, antithesis to produce synthesis. You provoke something so that you provoke a reaction which can lead to the result you really want. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. It's a revolutionary strategy. Louis XVI fell into the trap, was goaded into it. He attempted to flee with his family from France on the night of the 20th of June, 1791. When radicals discovered them, I'm sure they knew all about it well ahead of time, they blocked their path to shore to the border, escorted the royal family back to Paris. It was high drama, as depicted in this painting. Well, Danton and Robespierre seized upon this event as an opportunity to proclaim that France was a republic. The king has abdicated. By attempting to flee the country, he's effectively abdicated. We no longer have a constitutional monarchy, we have a republic. Which is, of course, what they wanted to do anyway, but they just needed some event to provoke it, a trigger. As the new Legislative Assembly met, 1st of October 1791, the Girondists proposed replacing the just adopted constitution and creating a republic. They'd no sooner got this Bill of Rights and this constitutional monarchy through, they are just meeting for the first meeting of this new National Assembly, and they're already throwing out their constitution and saying, let's start again. This is also the way revolutionaries work. Well, deeply concerned for the fate of the royal family, Austria, ruled by the brother of Mary Antoinette, King Leopold II, he prepared to invade France. But before he could do that, the assembly declared war on Austria in 1792, and the French were soon defeated by the Austrians and the Prussians, who had far better armies, far more motivated, more professional, and so on. Well, the mob, okay, you can't beat a real army in a field, but at least we can go and do some massacres. So the mob stormed the king's residence and massacred the royal Swiss guards. No French soldiers stood by King Louis XVI and family, but every one of the Swiss guards who were there primarily to protect Mary Antoinette died to the man, bravely. Interestingly enough, just across the street was a young captain from Corsica, Napoleon Bonaparte. And he saw this, and he thought, if the king had just ordered the artillery brought out, if they just fired on the mob, they could have prevented this and saved their lives. And he determined he would never, ever, ever let mobs survive. And for the whole of his life, Napoleon had a fear of the mob. And when he, what brought him to the attention of the directory of the National Assembly leaders was when he was willing to pull out the cannon and fire into a mob to disperse the mob when the mob was about to storm the assembly again. And Napoleon never trusted mobs. But he saw what happened at this particular massacre. And it was horrific. And all of these Swiss guards killed to the very last man. The assembly then voted to depose the king and write a new constitution. The king's statues toppled, very symbolically. 10th of August 1792, the municipal government of Paris was overthrown. And Danton proclaimed himself the new national dictator. What happened to the elections? What happened to the Bill of Rights? What happened to the Constitution? Forget all that. Now they've got a dictatorship. So we can't have a monarchy. We can't even have a constitutional monarchy. We're actually having a dictatorship. And Danton conscripted the entire male population for military service. Weapons production entered high gear. Danton is actually like Trotsky in Russia. He's the one who saves the revolution. If you've read Animal Farm, Danton is like Snowball. Snowball, Trotsky, Danton, same guy. And you can tell, if you've read Animal Farm, Major would be like Voltaire or Karl Marx. He's the philosopher, gives it. And Napoleon is the dictator, like Lenin or Stalin, who comes and takes control. So Animal Farm, you can see that George Orwell, he's got the number of these revolutionaries. And every revolution, you can actually see how there's four legs good, two legs bad, and no animal should kill another animal, and then later it's added without cause. And no animal may sleep in a bed, and somebody adds later with sheets. And shouldn't drink alcohol, that gets painted over totally. And on and on, how they've changed all their laws. Animal Farm actually gives a satirical look at exactly how revolutionaries work. On September 1792, terrorist mobs swarmed through the prisons and massacred thousands of prisoners, including many nobles who had been arrested for no other reason than they were nobility. And it was a hideous thing. Men, women, children, thousands of them, murdered by mobs wielding swords and clubs. And this September massacre preceded the arrest of the king himself. And the new National Assembly, which was called on 21st September 1792 to write a new constitution, they summoned the deposed king, Louis Coppet, as they now called him, and he was summarily tried and beheaded on the 21st of January 1793. You can see the gory practice of lifting up the head of the decapitated victim to the screaming mobs. All of Europe was horrified, and a coalition was formed against France. Austria, England, Holland, Prussia, Spain, Piedmont prepared to restore order to France. They could tell, this is terrible, and this will spread, and we've got to put an end to it now. And they mobilized, but they only had professional armies, small armies. France now had a totally mobilized population. The first time in history, you had total conscription of an entire population. And so France would be able to throw more men into the mix, which would just overwhelm the professional small armies of these neighboring countries. The Jacobins mobilized the mob to invade the convention and arrest the 31 leading Girondists. Up till now, the Girondists have been the leaders of the revolution. But now the Jacobins take over. And this launched the Reign of Terror, which officially began on the 2nd of June 1793. Robespierre established the Committee of Public Safety. Now, this is irony of a high order. When they speak of, the communists always have these lovely terms, Committee of Public Safety. These are guys who ran the terror. A policy of mass public terror was unleashed with revolutionary tribunals, in which all enemies of the revolution were summarily tried. And mere accusations were tantamount to verdicts of guilt. Trials were abrupt, with no real opportunity granted to the accused to prepare a defense or to present any defense. If you've seen the film, for example, of Charles Dickens' classic book, A Tale of Two Cities, you've got some idea how these trials went. The accused were quickly convicted and carted off to the guillotine and beheaded. The Queen, 38-year-old Mary Antoinette, was dragged through the mockery of a trial on the 16th of October, 1793, and she was guillotined the very next day. Absolutely outrageous treatment. For what possible reason would they do this? One day, trial, execution. Her son, later recognized as Louis XVII, died as a result of inhumane treatment by his revolutionary jailers. They separated him from the mother quite a long time before her death, and they tried to make him into an atheist. And they continually pressured him and cajoled and brainwashed him and did everything they could, depriving him of sleep and everything else, until they could get him to curse Christ and embrace atheism and renounce his Christian faith. And they said their goal was to ensure that the son didn't go to heaven to be with his mother, but went to hell with him. And that was the actual motivation of these revolutionary jailers. And when he finally cursed Christ and seemed to embrace atheism, they were satisfied and let him starve to death. That there are people in the world that would think like that. 21 Girondist leaders, including Madame Roland, were now beheaded shortly after the Queen. Now, these are the people who moved for the killing of the King and Queen, and they end up on the guillotine soon afterwards. And this is how revolutions work. Revolutionaries turn on one another. Those people who were treacherous to their rulers soon become treacherous to one another. It's an amazing thing. You find this in every revolution. Cambodia, Vietnam, Zimbabwe, Russia, every revolution, China, the revolutionaries end up killing one another. And these Girondists were the ones who had led so much of this, and they ended up dying in the same guillotine they'd condemned the king and queen to. The Duke of Orléans, who had joined the Jacobins and taken the name Citizen of Galatea, renouncing his nobility, even voting for the death of his cousin, the king, he was also executed at this time. So it obviously didn't do him any good. Romantic occultism taught a Big Bang theory of social science. You know, if you could blow up or burn down enough things and destroy enough buildings and kill enough people, you could produce utopia. Hey, after all, everything we've got around us is a result of a big explosion. Maybe if we could just blow up enough things, we'll produce utopia. Yes? Well, if the Big Bang works for science, maybe it can work for social science. The Reign of Terror spread throughout France. When one city sought to resist, it was destroyed. The revolutionaries set up a pillar outside Lyon and inscribed, "Lyon waged war with liberty. Lyon is no more." Toulon was subjugated under the leadership of a young artillery officer from Corsica, Major Napoleon Bonaparte. And the Committee of Public Safety launched a vicious atheistic war against Christianity. They invented a new religion which they called the Cult of Reason. How do you like that name? Just like the Committee of Public Safety. There's nothing reasonable about it. At a festival at the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, an actress was enthroned as the goddess of the French people, and France was renamed the Republic of Virtue. Ancient Rome was now lifted up as the model, because that's pre-Christian. And the press and the theatres were turned into instruments for state propaganda. You can't just entertain, you've got to propagandize. It's got to be for the good of the revolution. Fashions changed to loose, immoral Roman robes. Over 2,000 churches were renamed temples of reason and hijacked for the promotion of this cult. And here's a picture of a revolutionary women's group meeting in a church with the revolutionary flags. Marriages were now civil. Divorces were now civil. Historian Arnold Toynbee wrote, "In the revolution, a sinister ancient religion suddenly re-erupted with elemental violence, the fanatical worship of collective human power. The terror was only the first of the mass crimes that have been committed in this evil religion's name." The revolutionaries began to turn on one another. Danton, the number one revolutionary, was murdered, was executed, 5th of April, 1792. Marat was stabbed to death in his bath. On the 7th of May, Robespierre sought to impose a new religion on France, declaring a new calendar to replace the Christian calendar. Kind of AD and BC, that's centered on Christ. We need a new revolutionary calendar. So the 21st of September, 1792, is day one of the new calendar. Why? Because the day the monarchy ended. And this is declared the first day of the new year and era. They also abolished the 7-day work week and replaced with a 10-day work week. Didn't work, by the way, as you'd have noticed. Robespierre appointed himself the high priest of the supreme being in this new cult. And the supreme being effectively was the state, which actually meant the party, which really meant the leader of the party. On 27th of July 1794, Robespierre and 20 others of his henchmen were seized and executed by the survivors of the convention. When they realized, wait a minute, if Marat, if Danton, if Madame Roland, if Citizen Egalité, they can all get executed, it can happen to any of us at any time. And then Robespierre ended up on the same guillotine he had condemned everyone else to. And here he has been carted off to justice. More than 40,000 victims had been murdered on a guillotine under the reign of terror before Robespierre met his just end. 300,000 others had been murdered by firing squads or by drownings. Over two-thirds of these victims had been peasants, artisans, and workers. Not only nobles, most of the people, common people. As Madame Roland was being ushered up the platform to be guillotined, she faced the statue of the goddess Liberty and she cried out, "Oh, Liberty, Liberty, what crimes are committed in thy name?" She should know. She had been a chief cheerleader for the guillotine until that day. The end of the Reign of Terror was not the end of the French Revolution. It would be followed by the Directory, by the dictatorship, and eventually culminating in Napoleon's empire, which embroiled all of Europe in ruinous war. Even after the death of Robespierre, the revolution continued to talk about liberty, equality, fraternity. But there was no liberty or equality. They continued to fight against the Christian faith and to inspire more communes, more voices of virtue, more Vladimir Lenins, more Joseph Stalins, Fidel Castros, and Mao Zedongs. The French Revolution was the prototype, which had been followed by the Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, the Cuban Revolution, the Cambodian, Vietnamese, and Ethiopian revolutions, the Mozambican Revolution, the Angolan Revolution, the Zimbabwean Revolution, and many others. In every case, they proved that yesterday's revolutionaries can become tomorrow's tyrants and dictators. This is the face of freedom in Zimbabwe today. Christians in Samora Michelle Avenue, the old Jameson Avenue, face down on the tar, on the pavement, with a boot on their neck, being whipped by police carrying AK-47s in battle gear. Prayer protesters being whipped and beaten. 2 Peter 2 verse 19 can be written over every one of these revolutions. While they promise them liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption. Boy, are they ever slaves of corruption. This picture you'll recognize, the scene from Charles Dickens' book, A Tale of Two Cities. It's a far better thing I do now than I've ever done. It's a far greater rest I go to than I've ever known. That's the last words of the book. Beginning is, it was an age of reason, it was an age of foolishness. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And Charles Dickens wrote, I think, the classic definitive work on, as a novel, on the French Revolution. And when Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister of England, she presented President François Mitterrand of France with a letterbound copy of Charles Dickens' book, A Tale of Two Cities. I can't think of a more appropriate gift to give to the President of France than A Tale of Two Cities. It contrasts London and Paris, England and France. Christian England, under the influence of Wesley's and Whitfield's evangelical revival, and France under revolutionary secular humanism. The contrast between London and Paris, Christianity and secular humanism, is so sharp in A Tale of Two Cities. This is my favorite film on the French Revolution. It's a 1930s version. Kind of hard to get hold of, but we've got it at our mission in our library. And I would recommend, it's a 1930s version, big screen epic, thousands in the cast. I mean, they spared no effort in reproducing the whole drama on a big scale. But what I like about this is it's true to the book and it hasn't edited out the scripture and the Christian heart of the book. Unfortunately, modern versions have often left out a lot of the Christian material that's in Charles Dickens' original books. So while there's quite a lot of films on the Tale of Two Cities, I think the modern ones have gutted it of its heart and soul. The very best book on the French Revolution, if you want to read about it, is Robespierre, Inside the French Revolution by Otto Scott. This is absolutely superb. It is the textbook on the French Revolution, if you're wanting the full story in a drama. Now, it's for this reason that every year we have services and promote Reformation Day, and we bring outboard people here for many years, foreigners and school groups and others, to the Huguenot Monument, the Huguenot Museum, because I think that the Reformation Day is the high day for Protestants to celebrate. And that's what Frankfurt was founded on, the Reformation. Protestant Christians. 31st of October, when Martin Luther nailed the 95 theses to the church door, that is the Independence Day for the Protestant churches, so to speak. That's what 4th of July is for the Americans, what 14th July is for the French Revolutionary advocates. 31st October is to Christians. And I think a lot more should be done about promoting Reformation Day than Bastille Day. We need to understand our history. Karl Marx said, the first battlefield is a rewriting of history. And so I've put quite a bit of work as a missionary who has ministered in all these countries in Europe, and I've been in Wittenberg, and I've been in Zurich, and in Luther's house, and Zwingli's house, and been to the Cathedral of John Calvin, St. Pierre, many times, and had services there, and ministered from one side of the Reformation countries to the other. And so we've put together books and CDs and DVDs and audio cassettes, the MP3s on the Reformation. We are trying to give a biblical worldview and show our Christian heritage. And there are some great resources. Instead of following the heroes of the secular humanists, we should look at the Christian heroes of the faith. We need to get back to God's law, not the Declaration of the Rights of Man, because the rights of man are safer under God's law than are under these humanistic declarations. We also have an Afrikaans, Biblical Principles for Africa, and we have Biblical Principles for Africa in French as well. We need to reform our families. We need to revive our prayer meetings. Our goal is revival. So there's some great resources that we have made available, and if you're interested, I'll be very glad to answer any of your questions after this. I did put out a clipboard for anyone who wants to be on a frontline e-list or main list of frontline or Christian action. I've got two clipboards there. Some of our newsletters, just help yourself outside. I've got books and CDs on the table for sale there, and all those things out there are free. I see Joy Magazine's got a table also with great materials, and if you aren't subscribed to Joy Magazine, highly recommend it. It's a Christian alternative. We shouldn't be getting all our input from secular human sources, but from Christian. And so let's support that which is positive, which is built in the Reformation, not on the Revolution. Any questions at all about the French Revolution or anything I've shared about it? Yes, sir.
Peter, with regard to the monument, Huguenot monument, a lot of speculation of Freemasonry building it or memorabilia on it. Can you give me insight into that?
I'm not aware of that. What I see is a museum and a monument that we can use as a stepping stone to reminding people of what the Reformation stood for and the issues, and to fight against secular humanism, Freemasonry and all these other evils. So if there were Freemasonry symbols or intentions there, we're going to fight against that. But to me, what the Reformation stood for, that's the main thing. And the main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. So I've brought many people here to Franschhoek every year, foreigners and others. It's always an essential place. Bring them to the monument, bring them to the museum, bring school groups here to teach them what the Reformation stood for, why it came about, what its excellent results have been. And so it's wonderful to have a lightning rod, a monument and museum which we can use as a basis for that. But obviously, if there's anything we can do to make it more biblical, more historically accurate, more faithful to the spirit of the Huguenots, then we should do so. Any other comments, questions?
I think we just put in, we know Bastille, they celebrate Bastille here. But the whole of South Africa, the whole of the world. So I've shared with these guys here, Sodom and Gomorrah, to come back, they'd have to backslide to get to where we are at the moment. Now, we're living in a very secular world.
Yes, we are.
But I think what... But you taught me one thing about this Reformation Day, and I don't know, as a group, but maybe that's where we're going to focus. I mean, we should focus on something like that, and maybe it might be a change for us, you know, as a group, to start looking at something like that, and maybe get behind something like this. It would be a wonderful start for us. Have our own stalls and things like that. We're not going to get away from Bastille Day, because that's just, and they can tear it down. I mean, the people that come out so often now, 80% of them don't even know whether this is the God.
I'm quite aware of that. Mm. The point is, it's better to light a candle than to curse the darkness.
Yeah.
But let's not celebrate the darkness. So, what others may do, that's up to them. I'm not reading the secular humanist magazines, with one exception. I do subscribe to Time to know what the pagans are saying. Mm. But aside from that, that's my one window to the main thing of what the pagans say. But I want to get Christian publications otherwise. So World Magazine from America, Joy Magazine in South Africa, a lot of good Christian ministry newsletters, emails and so on, World Net Daily. I'm trying to get alternative sources of information and supporting good Christian community radio stations like Radio Tigerbird, getting good books, good Christian resources, having excellent CDs and MP3s to redeem the time when I'm driving in the car and so on, trying to get alternatives. And so also focusing, we're not going to stop them having Youth Day, Women's Day, Soweto Day, May Day, whatever it is. If they want to have a secular humanist holiday, that's fine. But we're going to remember Ascension Day. That's all about authority. That's about the Great Commission. That's about Jesus having all authority in heaven and earth. So we, you know, everything from Christmas, Easter, Good Friday, Ascension Day, Pentecost, through to Reformation Day. These are important for us as Christians. So we're going to put our energy into those. And yes, it's not like we can stop the world from celebrating darkness, evil, or whatever. That's their business. But our business is to focus our children and our neighbors and our friends on what really counts. So to me, it's a matter of lighting a candle. Rather than cursing darkness. We need to be aware of it. Ephesians 5:11 says, have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness, but rather expose them. But we're not into interfering with other people's freedom. If people are celebrating Bastille Day, that's their choice. We're talking about what we're going to focus on. So I would be delighted if you want to make use of us. I've been producing PowerPoint presentations on every aspect of the Reformation, and I took 1,400 pictures just in Wittenberg in 2 days. I've accumulated on every aspect of the books, the materials. Every Thursday night we meet in Rondebosch in Cape Town and look at some aspect of the Reformation. I'm refining every aspect, each reformer and the doctrines and the places and events, and it's exhilarating. We've got so many great things, and some Christian schools have us coming and colleges to give these presentations. I was recently up at the Reformed College in Zambia for 2 weeks on giving them Reformation history and as a guest lecturer. And so we've refined a lot of things on that. If you wanted to have a, but it's a roadshop focus on Reformation the week before or something like that, we'd be very glad to help. And there's good films. We can organize some, if you had time, if you would like to see some of the great films of the Reformation. And by the way, this film that I mentioned on the Tale of Two Cities, we've also got another one, a 1930s one, Mary Antoinette, which is far more sympathetic than the modern junk that brought out recently, made it into some kind of disco dancer, you know, with modern music even, just omnibus. And my wife and I saw about 5 minutes of that and walked out. Couldn't bear this modern and Mary Antoinette, but the old one, the classic 1930s one, is just so much more meaningful and humane, and looks as Mary Antoinette as a real person and a heroine, which I believe she was, even though she's been trashed by the secular humans. So if you want, we can bring up more of the films too, so we can lend to our friends and get more people seeing some alternatives. Any other questions or comments?
There's another bit of history going on from the Reformation Day. You go on to the Day of the Covenant. Now they've changed it now, they call it the Day of the Covenant. But that Day of the Covenant was when the four triplets arrived and they made a covenant with God that they would commit this country to God. As the early Americans did. Now we all, even if you watch the Americas, are going away from that today, and it's creating a lot of problem in America. And we've gone away from that Day of the Covenant, from those early, the four checkers. They committed it to God, and how we're drifting away from all of that. And a lot of our problems, and America's problems today, are direct, because you don't break a covenant with God. You see?
And Great Britain. Great Britain had a wonderful Christian heritage, and our father, British people, have fallen from the faith to an extent that they now want you to bring Muslim imams into the House of Lords. It's just unbelievable what they are doing in Britain. It's, and Britain needs to come back to Christ. It was once the greatest missionary-sending nation on earth. So there was such, you know, at one time France was 10% French Huguenot. 80% of the nobles were Protestant. There was a time when, before the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre, when France could have become Protestant. It was that close. And treachery, unfortunately, many of the Christians fought one another. Division amongst the believers didn't help. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot we can learn from history. But I would not write off Europe, South Africa, America, anyway. I believe we can win all our countries back to Christ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, back to God.
Absolutely. I believe we will win Saudi Arabia and Libya. I mean, not in our lifetime, but before the Lord comes, every knee will bow, every tongue will confess Jesus Christ is Lord. I believe He will fulfill the Great Commission before the return of Christ. I've got every confidence that the Lord had gave the Great Commission and promised all power, and that He would be with us and that we would perform miracles and see signs following, that we will see the performance of the Great Commission. Not in our lifetimes, but we're working towards it. And inevitably, God's cause will triumph. So, we're looking at this, but I'm not fearful for the force of revolution, because the forces of revival are greater. We are looking forward to a great revival and see these evils overwhelmed.
So,
can
I just have a question?
I've got to look at some books, because I'm going to go.
Yes, of course. Yes.
My question is, I've not read your material on the Reformation, but I've done some reading on the Reformation. I sometimes teach on the Reformation. I just want to know your stand between, you know, the intellectual aspect, basically, which is the teaching and, you know, creating an awareness of what the Reformation, you know, is and is done in terms of the historical background to the spiritual aspect, which is basically the reforming of the human nature.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that the Reformation has to do with the reconstruction of man, because all that you've explained now deals with the fallen human life, the human ideology.
Yeah.
You know. So how do you take the spirit of Reformation and impart it into?
I understand. Well, of course, you see what we are doing. We are not just dealing with the heart. John Calvin's principle was, his motto was, a heart aflame in the hand of God, promptly and sincerely in the service of my God. And the symbol was a heart aflame. And so we need not just reformed minds, we need revived hearts. We need, and this is what the Puritans did. The Puritans managed to have doctrinal backbones of steel, strong reformed doctrine, but they had hearts aflame. And so we need to have the fire of the Reformation. So you will see in all of our emphasis where we're going. We're going to reviving our prayer life, our devotional life. Revival is the core. It is not just up here. It's got to be head, heart, and hands. So we talk about reviving body, soul, and spirit, all aspects. Comprehensive performance of the Great Commission. Nothing less is good enough.
The question is, how do you take that into the church? Because today you see in the church we're so full of knowledge of the Reformation.
I don't know if they even are full of the knowledge.
Okay, I guess maybe where I come from. People are aware that there's a Reformation. People even try to differentiate the Reformation from revival. I don't understand what you're talking about. The awakening of the spirit. But how do you take that? How do people come to a realization that, you know, the Reformation is the core of Christianity? Yeah. Is this life?
You get the answer in most of our materials that are on the tables, the literature and the books and CDs. You'll see continually how we are working on those balances. But quite a lot of CDs dealing with these very things and the books. But yeah, that's what we try and do regularly. Is Reformation is our work. Reformation is us taking God's word seriously. Revival is God's sovereign move. We cannot bring about revival, but we can pray for it. But Reformation we can do. And normally we find in the Bible that as kings and leaders work for biblical Reformation has started, God often blessed it with revival. So, we're not suggesting we can ever work up or pray down revival. Revival is a sovereign move of God. But we do know, and that's why we distinguish. We're not trying to separate them as much as recognize between our duty and God's sovereignty. Reformation is our duty. Revival is God's move, gracious move. Thank you so much.
Peter, thank you. What a bloody period of history. I had no idea. You had us all mesmerized.
Thank you
so much. And what a wonderful walk through history, backed up by magnificent pictures. Thank you very much.
Thank you.